Mark Ezek is the author of Lesser Beasts, a snout-to-tail history of the humble pig from Basic Books. He holds a Ph.D. in U.S. history from Cornell, and he's also the author of a book, Edison and the Electric Chair, which, just as an aside, I had a chance to read several years ago. Highly recommended. Good morning, Mark Ezek, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Milt. It's great to be here. Thanks for the kind words about the first book as well.
I'm a big Edison fan, so you had me right there at the title.
Perfect.
Let's talk a little bit about the pig and this complex history we've had. If you go back to the Old Testament, for example, there's a prohibition for the Hebrew people against eating pigs. And they've had different points in history. It seems like they've been embraced or pushed away. Kind of give us a broad overview of that.
The best way to think about human attitudes toward pigs is to start at the very beginning. Pigs are descended from the Eurasian wild boar, which lived all over Eurasia from Southeast Asia all the way to England. And then about 10,000 years ago, people first settled into villages in what is now Turkey. And when people get together in villages, one of the things they do best is produce garbage. And so scientists think that what happened with pigs is that these Eurasian wild boars started lurking around town, and pigs, like people, are omnivores. They'll eat just about anything people will eat, and one of the things they like to eat was human garbage. We're talking about butchery scraps or spoiled grains or burnt food, and this was a tremendous service that these pigs were providing, because these wild boar lurked into town, they cleaned up the food, and what's thought is that gradually the pigs that were best in this role, who weren't dangerous to humans, but who were bold enough to be around humans in order to collect this food source, gradually they evolved into a separate lineage that we know of as the domestic pig. The advantage of having these animals around was that they cleaned up the mess and, as a side benefit, provided meat and fat as well. But as you might imagine, those same qualities of eating garbage and cleaning up the mess also led people to think that they had some rather disgusting habits. And if you are what you eat, then you didn't want to be eating creatures that ate filth.
Yes, some of the stuff that they ate was pretty revolting, including human flesh. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's lots of references in ancient literature, sort of curses on people that would say, "May dogs and pigs eat your flesh." So if you would have a battle and you would leave bodies laying around on the battlefield, then probably by that night, then you would have some pigs scavenging among there. The pig is in its digestive system, its teeth, its gut, its stomach, it's very much like a person. And like people, they like to eat flesh. And as I say in the book, of all the creatures that humans commonly eat, the pig is the only one that is happy to return the favor.
For poor people throughout history, the pig has been an important source of protein, hasn't it?
It has been, and that's because of the way pigs were raised. If you wanted to raise a cow or a goat or a sheep, for the most part, you needed access to pasture, and that wasn't something that most poor people had. But a pig, all you had to do was build a little pen attached to your hut, or even let it run loose in the city streets, where this free food source was available in the form of garbage. And there are, it's thought that the reason that pigs and pork became thought of as the animal of the poor and the animal of poor people was because this was the one food resource they could grow on their own. It was a domestic source of food. And you could raise it yourself, slaughter it yourself, and cure it to last you through the winter. It was a tremendous boon to people who didn't have many resources.
And the gestation period is very short, isn't it?
Yeah, a cow gestates for about 9 months, and it'll give you one calf or maybe two calves. And each of those calves will take a couple of years to reach a weight where you can kill and eat them. But a pig gestates for just less than half that long, just less than 4 months. It'll give you 6 or 8 or 12 or maybe even more piglets, and each of those modern pigs will grow the slaughter weight in 5 months. So if you want to produce a lot of meat very quickly, then the pig is the animal for you. And then the other advantage, as I just mentioned, is that their meat cures so well. When we think of beef, we tend to think of its fresh cut, steaks, hamburgers, roasts, but most of the more famous cuts of pork tend to be cured. Bacon, of course, and hams and sausages. These were things that you could cure with salts and smoke, and then they could be kept at room temperature for a year or more. And in the time before artificial refrigeration, which is a fairly modern invention, only the past 100 years or so has it been common, this was a way that you could take the harvest of the fall, fatten your pig on the corn or the acorns or whatever you had available in the summer and fall, kill it, and then you would have a meat source all the way through the winter. It was a tremendous advantage.
One of the things that I read in your book that surprised me, I've always heard that trichinosis was a big issue, especially for people anciently, but you're saying not so much.
Yeah, that's a theory that became popular in the late 19th century. The trichinosis, the mechanism, the parasite that causes that, was discovered in the 1850s, and within the next couple of decades, that became the most popular theory for why the ancient Israelites banned pork. And there's a lot of theories, different theories about the origins of the pork taboo, but just about everybody agrees that trichinosis wasn't the cause of it. There's no solid evidence that it even existed in the ancient Near East, and there were plenty of other diseases, anthrax and others, that could be caught not only from pigs but from other livestock. So to think that this one particular disease caused this rather profound taboo that stretched it existed not only in ancient Israel, but also in Mesopotamia and down through Egypt. It seemed to be a much broader cultural prejudice and not a single causation caused by a disease.
Compared to beef or to chicken or fish, where is pork in terms of consumption in America?
Chicken is by far the most popular, meat. This is something... Americans tend to think of ourselves as a nation of beef eaters, but that's really a matter of aspiration more than reality, at least until after World War II. Because pigs reproduce so abundantly, because their meat cured so well, because we had this tremendous resource known as the Corn Belt, all that corn was grown and fed to pigs as well as cows. Pork was... it cured well, it was available very cheaply, and Americans ate far more pork than beef until after World War II. Then beef gained the upper hand, but starting in the 80s or so, well, really starting a little bit earlier than that, 60s, 70s, and 80s, chicken became by far the most popular meat, and pork has been struggling to catch up ever since.
Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. Joining us this morning is Mark Essick. He holds a PhD in U.S. history from Cornell, and he has written a new book called Lesser Beasts, a snout-to-tail history of the humble pig. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. I remember, Mark, this will date me, but this long-standing, ongoing joke on The Tonight Show where Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon would debate who was smarter, a pig or a horse. And I think, as I recall, Johnny Carson maintained that it was the pig. He grew up in Nebraska, I think, on a farm or in farm country. The pig really is a pretty smart animal, isn't it?
Yeah, the pig has... I would start just with anecdotal evidence. I spent some time working on a farm. I live in western North Carolina, a town called Asheville, and there's a college in town called Warren Wilson College that has a working farm. And I spent time among the animals, and just being around pigs, you can tell that there's a lot going in inside their heads. They are immensely curious creatures. You might compare them to dogs in the way that they will run away and then come back and sniff and prod at your boots. And in comparison to the sort of the placidness, the uncaringness of cows and sheep, they just seem smarter. There have been some tests conducted, behavioral tests about what pigs are capable of doing. My favorite test involved a pig in a pen, and you would show it where some food was hidden, and it could dig up that food. But if you introduced a second pig to the pen that didn't know where that food was, then the first pig would delay digging it up until the second pig was gone, so it didn't have to share. So there's there's those qualities. My favorite theory about pig intelligence has to do with the fact that pigs are omnivorous. When you compare them to cows or sheep, their main task is to spot something green, a leaf, a piece of grass, bite it, and start chewing it. Whereas a pig, it has a much bigger menu, and it has to select what it can eat or not. When a pig can discover a novel source of food, that gives it a tremendous selective advantage. It has energy available to it that other pigs and other creatures don't have. But on the other hand, if it selects a source of food that's dangerous, say a poison mushroom, then that's not so good for it. So I describe the pig as a judicious risk taker. It evolved to have to make judgments about what it could eat and what it couldn't eat. And in so doing that, it developed a quality that we call intelligence.
In literature, the pig is often described as being clever. Of course, there's Animal Farm by George Orwell. Have we always seen the pig as being a clever animal, or is that something that's fairly modern?
It seems to stretch at least as far back as the ancient Greeks and Romans. It was Circe, when she cursed Odysseus's men, she turned them into swine, and there's sort of a suggestion that there wasn't much of a difference between pigs and people. Pliny the Elder tells a story about a load of pigs that were on a ship that was listing to one side and threatening to sink, and the pigs were clever enough to crawl over onto the other side to right the boat. And there are stories of what you would call a Judas pig who would lead the other pigs to slaughter and then come home again. This recognition that pigs had capabilities that our other livestock had, it goes back quite far.
Interesting. Jeannie in Medford sent in a question. She would like to know what gives pork that sweet taste.
I'm not good on the physiology of pork. I will say there's one of the things that's particularly good about pork is that the fat is all throughout the muscle. They have a high percentage of intramuscular fat. And in addition to, there's some chemical differences in it that distinguish the flavors. But the presence of the fat all the way through is one of the reasons that it cures so well. Especially leaner cuts of meat, of beef and mutton, they would not cure as well because they're not as fatty. And one of the things that gives pork its ability to preserve well is the presence of fat all through the flesh.
If you have a question or comment about pigs, we're talking this morning with Mark Essick and his new book that he's written, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx at jeffnet.org. There has been a lot of concern lately about factory farming and the way that animals are treated in some of these facilities. Does that apply to pigs as well?
Yes, I would say it applies to pigs. As when you talk about factory farm conditions in the U.S., it's really poultry and pigs that have been most thoroughly industrialized in their production. Cattle, they still grow rather slowly. They need to spend the first part of their life on the range eating grass. Whereas pigs, most of them are slaughtered at 6 months of age, and they don't need grass. So what happens is most pigs are born to sows. The sows spend their entire lives in gestation crates, which are metal crates, mostly about 2 by 7 feet. They give birth in a slightly larger crate, known as a farrowing crate, and then those pigs are kept indoors, standing on slatted floors. Slatted floor was really the invention that allowed modern pig farming, because when you have pigs indoors, the worst part of it is that their waste accumulates. But with the slatted floor, what that means is that their waste, the pigs themselves, trample it through these gaps in the floor into a sewer below that can then be flushed out with water. And generally they have no straw or dirt or any soft materials available to them at all. So the pigs are born indoors to mothers kept in these confined conditions. They spend their lives on these hard floors indoors, and then they go to slaughter at 6 months or so of age.
They get no exercise, no sunlight. Is that correct?
That's correct. Other than the exercise of standing around packed together in these rather small group pens.
And what does that do to the quality of the meat?
Well, there's a few factors involved in the quality of the meat. One of the things it's allowed is when you're raising pigs in these conditions, you can very carefully control the genetics. And we talked earlier about the transformation in American culinary preferences from beef and pork to chicken and turkey. And one of the things, when that transformation started to happen, the pork industry worked very hard to make pork as lean as possible. They used very carefully controlled genetics and artificial insemination to make pork as lean as chicken. Most people, or at least some people, will remember the Other White Meat campaign, which got started in the late 1980s. And that was an attempt to convince people that pork was not bloody and fatty like beef, but it was pale and lean like chicken. And one of the things that breeding did, it actually was very successful. The pork chops, pork loins are extremely lean now. But in that rush to make it as lean as possible, they neglected flavor, and that's something that even you'll find within the pork industry, people admitting that, that they made it lean, but they also made it dry and flavorless.
Are we seeing a return to, I guess, what I would call more natural pig farming? Is there pressure on the industry to make these factory farms a little more humane?
There is. I would say that the changes so far have been significant, but they are all still in process. There have been some very successful campaigns led by the Humane Society of the United States and some other groups that are trying to persuade. Generally, the way the pressure works is the consumer groups pressure the restaurants like McDonald's or other large chains, and then the chains will pressure their suppliers. They say people don't want to eat pork raised from sows that are raised in these gestation crates. So most of the major pork producers now have vowed to stop producing pork in this way. But there's a pretty long horizon on this. They have a lot invested in the barns the way they're currently set up. It's hard to convert. So it's generally over a period of 5 to 10 or even more years that this transformation will happen. So it is beginning to change, but not a lot has changed yet.
If you have a question, join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. For family farms around the country, how popular is raising pigs compared to, say, some of the other options?
It depends what you mean by a family farm. The pork industry would say that most of their farmers are family farms, even the ones who are running farms with 5,000 pigs raised indoors. And that's certainly true. Many of them are owned by families, but it's just that they're operating under a contract to a major pork producer. The smaller scale farms, pigs have become very popular for historic reasons. Where I live, I'm familiar with, say, somebody, a farm is raising vegetables, they will keep a few pigs around in order to eat the leftover vegetables. And that's always been the traditional role of pigs on the farm. They were the converters of agricultural waste. In China, the pigs ate rice bran after the milling of rice, and that was what the pigs ate. And then the bonus at the end of the year was that you could slaughter these pigs. And on a larger scale, that carried through in the United States, most up through the 1930s and 1940s, even in the Corn Belt. Most farms had mixed production. They grew their own corn. They grew their own soy. They had dairy. They had hogs. And it was part of a mixed system. It's only in the last 50 years or so that we've had specialization. One person raises the corn, another one raises the pigs, another one raises the cattle. So there has been a return to more old-fashioned forms of agriculture, in part because there's a demand. People are upset by industrial agriculture and they want a different option. But I would say in terms of the percentage of pork in America raised in these more traditional ways, it's minuscule, less than 1%, I'd say.
So in the early days of American history, farmers, did most families tend to have at least one or two pigs?
Pigs, that was one of the things that surprised me most when I was doing my research. Pigs were simply everywhere in colonial and pioneer America. When the English were founding colonies in New England and Virginia, they would bring pigs along and they would just release them into the woods. We think of the open range as being a Western phenomenon, but most of the country was open range, and most of the animals on that range were pigs, because they had this tremendous hardwood forests with acorns and chestnuts and beechnuts, and the pigs, which I should say, are not native to the New World. They were an Old World creature, but they just found the New World forest to be heaven. And not only in the forest, they were also, pigs lived on the streets of New York into the 1840s and 1850s. There's reports of Charles Dickens, when he wrote a book about his journey to America, he observed pigs walking down Broadway in Manhattan. They were everywhere. They were the everyday source of meat for everyone, regardless of where they lived.
What about pigs as an invasive species then over history and especially today? Are they hunted from helicopters like other things? You know, I know that sometimes wolves have been.
They are, at least in Texas. That's a few years ago, Texas legalized hunting from helicopters by anyone. You could just rent a seat on a helicopter. That's in part the legacy of these open-range practices. When you keep pigs on the range, you don't round all of them up. And pigs are very resourceful, the same reasons that made them good in colonial times when they could survive by themselves in the woods, as means that they don't really need people, so that they reproduce very quickly. There are some counts that there are pigs by the million. It's a particular problem in the Southeast, particularly in Texas, but I know you have problems with them on the Pacific Coast as well. They just do very well in the wild, and they're very hard to eradicate. Most indications are that hunting actually exacerbates the problem by making the pigs more wary. The counties that have had more success eliminating a feral pig problem tend to trap them.
Because of the size of the litters, do we have an ongoing problem with too many pigs in America, too many feral pigs, or is that like a relatively small problem these days?
It's considered to be a large and growing problem in the, I hear most about Texas. There's also a big problem in Australia that's very similar. They're very destructive to the environment. They tear up wetlands. They will eat amphibians, ground nesting birds. When they come close to the suburbs, they will root up golf courses and your carefully manicured lawns. And the livestock producers are scared of them because they can carry certain livestock diseases like brucellosis that pose a danger of spreading from these feral herds to the commercial herds.
In your process of writing and researching this book, has it changed your appetite at all for pork?
I've become much more careful. I don't eat pork unless I know where it came from. I have access to small farms, and I know how they raise their pigs, and I'm comfortable eating those. When I look back and I see the amazing things that pigs have done, more or less domesticating themselves on city streets, living on barley in Roman barns, roaming through the forests of the medieval world, living in city streets, I just gained such respect for the creatures. And there's an ancient tradition that we know of as husbandry. It's a word not spoken of much. That when you raise an animal, you have responsibilities to treat it well before you slaughter it and eat it. And so I'd like to honor that tradition. And so unless I know that the pig lived a good life before it met its end, then I won't eat that pig.
I wonder, when I read historically that certain societies have or religious groups have not wanted to have anything to do with the pig, I contrast that to, you can hardly open up Facebook without seeing a meme at least once a day about people who love bacon. And this is kind of a funny question, but it seems like, did they not have a chance to taste bacon, or would that have changed their whole minds about pigs?
Oh, you mean the people who have a pork taboo?
Yes.
It's a good question. You certainly hear about bacon vegetarians who are vegetarian other than but they will eat bacon. There is a special quality to the fat and the salt and the smoke of bacon that makes it hard for many of us to resist.
As we say in our family, you can fix any meal with bacon. In culinary history, for restaurants or in other situations like festivals or things, have pigs played an important role?
Yeah, the pigs were often the centerpiece of feasts because they were so fecund. You could kill a lot of them, and they would reproduce quickly. So there's evidence of pigs serving as fertility symbols going back even to pre-Roman times into the Neolithic. There's lots of evidence of pig feasts among the Celts of Europe, of pre-Roman Europe. And the same quality, say, of Bartholomew Fair, which was a famous and famously riotous fair in Renaissance and early modern England. The Bartholomew pig, which was a whole roast pig, was at the center of it. It's good to remember that this was a time when people didn't eat very much meat. So to have a pig on a festival day was a special thing.
We're speaking with Mark Essick, the author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. You can call us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back with your questions. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Mark Essick. He holds a PhD in U.S. history from Cornell and the author of the latest book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. And we have some callers that have been on the line waiting patiently. Let's go to Bill in Eugene. Go ahead, Bill. We're trying to get Bill.
There, and I have a question. He said he would really watch where he got his pork from, and I'm 100% behind that. And I just wonder if he knew right now that there's a movement to stop the origin of where our food comes from label that's on all our food right now, because under the NAFTA free trade agreement, either Canada or Mexico changed something with their labeling system. So now they're saying it's unfair for us to put origin labels on our food, and they're trying to do away with it. And I wonder if he knew about that, and if that happens, how is he going to find out where his pork comes from? And I also wonder how he feels about the new free trade agreement that Obama's pushing as far as tracking our food and other food measures.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, the cool, our country of origin labeling. It does seem to be under threat. I'm in favor of it. I would say that I think that there needs to be much more transparency in our entire food system, not only meat but the rest of our food as well. For me, it's not even enough. Country of origin is a good start, but I actually want to know farm of origin. It takes a lot more work. You have to search out farmers markets or specialty grocery stores that will provide more information on it. You have to pay more for it. To me, it's worth the extra effort. It's worth the extra expense. I've dealt with the extra expense by eating less meat. And I am concerned on a global scale with free trade and, you know, Smithfield, one of the major, the biggest pork producer in the U.S. was a couple years ago acquired by a Chinese company. And so like the rest of industry, the meat industry has gone global because most of the growth is in emerging markets, including China. That's where you have a lot of people who are finally getting enough money to be able to afford meat. And if you look back historically, when people finally rise out of extreme poverty and they have a little money to spend, one of the first things they spend it on is meat. And that's happening in China now on a vast scale. Obviously, they have a huge population, 1.3 billion people who want to eat meat. And it's the desire of these global meat companies to move meat around the world, to make it as opaque as possible where that meat came from, how it was raised, that it's in their interest to make things as non-transparent as possible. So I'm definitely in favor of country of origin label. I would promote farm of origin labeling myself as well.
Jacob is on the line in Springfield. Go ahead, Jacob.
Hi. I wanted to point out something, the relationship between the pig and civilization. And you could cook or undercook beef or chicken or mutton, and you won't die. But if you undercook the pig, you do risk getting a brain parasite. We call it cysticercosis tenia. But it is endemic everywhere in the world. It's endemic in North Africa, in Europe, and even in China. But the difference is, I guess, before there was such thing as like germ theory and washing our hands, the people in the Mideast were desert people, and they really didn't believe in washing your hands. They just, if you read the prescriptions in the Quran and the Old Testament of the Bible, they, instead of washing their hands, they instructed women who bled for menses to be separated from men and separated from society so that the blood actually wouldn't contaminate other things and spread blood-borne diseases. And they even had, of course, they couldn't just tell people to wash their hands. And in the Quran, they ask people to eat with the right hand and then wipe their bottom with the left hand, so that way those two hands don't really touch. But they didn't believe in washing their hands. But it's the same way with pork tapeworm. The Chinese actually, the way they cook their pork actually sterilizes it, and it keeps it and it stores it, and they never had the same problem with a brain parasite. Eventually what happens to these patients is they get seizures, they go anoxic, they become vegetables, and then they die. Okay, but here's an interesting anecdote. Jewish people, during Christmas and Easter, they go to Chinese restaurants for a family meal. And Chinese cuisine is permeated with pig. Even in things like soup and vegetables that you think don't have any meat in it, they have pork flavoring and pork fat and bacon and everything else in there.
Jacob, did you have a specific question?
Well, it's interesting that Jews today don't eat pork, but they go to Chinese restaurants and they know pork is endemic there. I just wanted to stress that sometimes, the major texts of religions are influenced by bad ideas because they didn't have science and germ theory, and the power of a brain parasite to actually change civilization.
You know, it's Mark, it's certainly, we touched a little bit on this before, that, throughout history, our attitudes of pork have certainly been shaped by where we've lived and the things we believe, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. The broad patterns I've tended to notice across, starting 3000 BC to the present, our attitudes towards pigs tend to do mostly with how the pigs are raised. One of the reasons we talked about how they were rejected in the Near East, and one of the reasons for that, the ancient Near East, was because they lived on the streets and scavenged and ate filth. But at the same time, they were broadly embraced in ancient Rome. Nobody has quite loved the pigs the way the ancient Romans did. They feasted on them as they feasted on no other creatures. They developed these elaborate recipes for suckling pigs and for disgusting things like roast udder of lactating sow. Pork was the prime delicacy of the Roman diet. And the best reason I could come up with for that is that is because of the way pigs were raised. The Italian peninsula is not a desert. The pigs could live in the oak forests and eat acorns. The Romans were rich, and they imported grain from all over the Mediterranean world so they could feed their pigs on barley and wheat. And I've really seen that pattern carry through. In the early medieval period, when in Europe, when the pigs lived in the forests, they were embraced. Pigs were loved as the Romans loved pigs by the Europeans. Later, when those forests were cut down, pigs took up scavenging again, and they came to be regarded as filthy. So the pattern of embracing a pig that lives a clean life, rejecting a pig that eats filth, I find that carries through almost to the present, even to when we're starting to reject the pig, not so much because they eat filth, but because of the inhumane conditions that they're raised under. It's sort of a new form of pig disgust that's directed not at the pigs themselves, the way humans used to, but rather at the people who are forcing pigs to live under these inhumane conditions.
Kathy in Grants Pass, she touches on this. She sent us an email, and she says that the whole subject of pig factory farming to her is a kind of horror. It shows a lack of compassion and empathy in human beings. And then eating these creatures, she says to her, is akin to cannibalism. That's kind of some of the attitude that existed in the Middle Ages, wasn't it? When people first realized that pigs could eat other human beings or other things that they found, you know, unacceptable, it was like assumed that that almost like cannibalism, right?
Yeah, and the pig occupied a strange position here. For one thing, because they lived so close to homes, people often treated them as a sort of pet. You would feed it the leftovers from your dinner plates. The difference being they became an edible pet. You would eat them come fall. And so there was an uneasy making process. And then when you would slaughter a pig, you would see that you would scrape off its hair, and all of a sudden you would see that pig skin looked very much like human skin. You would gut it and see that its interior, its digestive system looked very much like you. There were widespread reports that human flesh tasted very much like pork. I can't verify that for you, fortunately. There are reports of a butcher who was selling human flesh as pork meat until one unfortunate diner found a finger in his sausage, and the butcher was exposed as having done this. So the thought that when we are eating a pig, we are eating our close kin is inescapable, and it goes back quite a long ways.
Medically, pigs have been used for the development of insulin, and today a lot of talk about organ transplants and some medical developments along that line. How has that played into things?
One of the things, when I would research the scientific literature, I would realize that a lot of the biological research on pig physiology was directed not just at pig farmers looking to raise as much meat as quickly as possible, but also as scientists who want to use pigs as models for human disease, because their physiology is so much like ours, then they serve as good models, particularly for diseases like diabetes that humans as well as pigs are prone to. We use them for heart valves now. They're developing transgenic pigs that might produce organs that would be more easily accepted in when they're transplanted into humans. So it shows the tight relationship, not only in the way that we have lived together all these years, but in the way that our bodies in some ways have evolved along similar lines.
We're speaking with Mark Essick. He is the author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig from Basic Books. If you'd like to join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about some of the hard conditions in modern pig farming and factory farming, but we specifically looked just at the pig. What about the workers who are in those conditions as well? Do they face some bad working conditions?
One of the surprising things about modern pig farming is how few workers it takes to manage very large herds. When you're confining these animals to very tight conditions, one thing it means is that you don't need that many people to do it compared to more old-fashioned forms of farming, and that, of course, is one of its advantages as far as the pork producers are concerned, because labor costs obviously are something they are trying to avoid. For the ones who do, it can pose dangers because of often they have to wear respirators because of all of the confined pigs, and their waste can produce it produces ammonia and a hydrogen sulfide and some other rather dangerous gases. And then I would say the biggest labor problems occur in the slaughtering in the slaughterhouses. Those slaughterhouses have been de-skilled so that the workers are performing simple repetitive actions again and again. For long days, many of these workers are undocumented immigrants, and so they have very little power to challenge the work conditions. There have been some particular disease clusters. There was one at the plant that produces one of the Hormel plants in Minnesota. Neurological diseases that are thought to have been spread by conditions on certain lines. So it's. The modern forms of producing pork are not only bad for the pigs, they tend to be bad for the people who are raising them and slaughtering them as well.
For people who want to move away from factory farmed animals of any kind and buy ones that are raised on farms by families or whatever, is there websites out there where you can find this kind of information, where you can vet your pig?
There are a few groups that do what's known as third-party certification. The one I'm most familiar with is called Animal Welfare Approved. And this is a group that will travel around to farms, and the farmers pay a fee. And this group has protocols that say, if you want to get our stamp, then our seal of approval, then you have to raise your pigs under these conditions. And they're subject to inspections, and they have to raise pigs in certain ways to get that. So a group like that can lead you to farms that will raise pigs in ways that you might be more comfortable with. Some of usually natural food stores, if they sell meat, will know more about where the pigs come from. The Whole Foods chain has developed its own rating system of 1 through 5, with 5 being the best for the conditions under which those animals are raised. I tend to buy most of mine at farmers markets, where I can actually talk to the farmer. The thing I want to add is, like, I know that this is expensive. You will always be paying more for this type of meat. I understand that that's not something that everybody can afford. I understand that I'm in a position of privilege because of where I live and because of a certain income level to be able to do that. Well, I want to acknowledge that. Yeah.
Mark Essig, thanks for joining us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. Again, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
That's it for today's exchange. You can find out more at jeffexchange.org. Tomorrow we'll be back. Jeffrey Riley will be here. Our producer is with us today is Emily Curtin. And I'm Mel Bradford. Thanks for listening.